we'll proceed to the third case of the day, Wiley versus the State of Illinois. Mr. Watson?
Yes, sir.
May I proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Chuck Watson. I represent Jerry Wiley, an African-American former chief counsel of the Illinois Department of Veterans Affairs. Not chief counsel, chief financial officer, sorry. Mr. Wiley is a term appointee. Term appointees in the state of Illinois receive civil service protection for the period of 4 years. That term may be non-renewed, to raise a term just bandied about, for any reason.
That's our theme for today, non-renewal.
Non-renewals can happen under state law for any reason or no reason. Differentiating this case from the prior case, however, is that Mr. Wiley has stated that his non-renewal was the product of a bias against him as an African-American. Filed his matters before the EEOC, case notice of right to sue was issued, case was proceeded before Judge Scott, and resulted in a summary judgment. The problem with the summary judgment, Your Honor, was that Judge Scott misapplied both of the facts and the law. As I understand it, the major items of contention in this appeal and before the court below were the proper methods of reviewing the evidence before the court. The trial court in this case applied McDonnell Douglas as a formula, as if it had to be followed in one particular manner, rather than as the flexible standard of analysis and presentation of proof that the Supreme Court intended when it established the rule. Furthermore, the court did not review the evidence with any... refused to consider circumstantial evidence except as it was analyzed under McDonnell Douglas, rather than allowing it to be presented as its own form of direct evidence of discrimination. As this court has stated in Venturelli just within the last couple months, you can have two ways of presenting direct evidence. The one that never occurs, we don't like black people in this place, so you're fired. That doesn't occur anymore. The court in Venturelli also said, however, that direct evidence or direct method of proof can contemplate the use of circumstantial evidence. The court refused to consider any of to use the term the Seventh Circuit used, the bits and pieces, as anything other than part of the McDonnell Douglas formula.
Are these bits and pieces set out on page 32 and 33 of your brief?
In large part, Your Honor, they're scattered throughout.
Well, you just happen to have a list of nine. And with none with any reference to a record.
Your Honor, I believe that those nine listed on those two pages are referenced elsewhere in the brief, and as the person who didn't write the brief or do the summary judgment, I would offer the court or ask the court if they wish for me to present a supplemental brief properly citing those things to the record if the court so desires. I'm arguing the brief that I was presented when Mr. Jones had to recuse himself from this case when he rejoined state government and obviously had to get out from being involved as plaintiff's counsel in a state government. The court below also went on to argue or to analyze the case in terms of McDonnell Douglas, but misapplied McDonnell Douglas. The court essentially centered in on one method of proving the fourth element of a McDonnell-Douglas case. The first three elements of the McDonnell-Douglas analysis didn't appear to be at much issue in the case, although I'm sure counsel would disagree with me. Clearly, Mr. Wiley wasn't a protected class. He was qualified for the job, and at least in terms of performance evaluations and a lack of any notations in his personnel file, was apparently doing an adequate job. I do note that counsel for the department has stated that any quibble with what Mr. Wiley was doing as the chief fiscal officer means that he was not doing an adequate job. This court has time, as has the Supreme Court time and time again, said you don't have to be the best employee as long as you're doing an adequate job. There was clearly an adverse job action here. He was, in all intents and purposes, fired or non-renewed. His term was non-renewed.
Well, that's a big difference.
Well, it is a big difference under state law, but not under federal law. Under state law, Mr. Wiley is not allowed to take an appeal or grieve the non-renewal of his term. But that's a firing. He wouldn't get to come back to work the next day. And if it was because he was a black man as opposed to a white man, that was still an illegal and adverse job action.
Well, I suppose you could allege it was a failure to hire, I guess.
If you wanted
to use a discriminatory reason, I assume then some person not in the protected class took the position. That's what you're trying to say is why that meets the fourth test somehow.
Precisely.
Mm-hmm. Then it goes on, then it goes on to the issue of proving pretext.
That's right. We do go on to pretext in this case. In pretext in this case, Your Honor, the judge, a fair review of the record on the appeal of this case, the summary judgment below, the court in at least one case specifically made a credibility determination in favor of Director Johnson. Director Johnson contradicted himself both in his answers to interrogatories, his original pleadings before the EEOC, and then later on at his deposition went on for four pages about how Mr. Wiley had created a hostile atmosphere among certain specific members of the management team at the Department of Veterans Affairs. After the fact, realizing for whatever reason that he'd clearly made a horrible mistake, changed his testimony, and substituted in the names of three other people. Despite having explained why these people were the ones that Mr. Wiley had treated poorly, he changed it without any real explanation in the errata sheet. The judge said that raised no question of credibility. All through the summary judgment, Your Honor, the argument was made and the evidence was presented that the reasons for the termination or the non-renewal were after the fact, made up after the fact, that there is nothing in the record that predates my client's arguments that he was terminated because he was race that supports the decision of the director to not renew his term.
Some of these memos that were written by Mr. Wiley, long, rambling, attacking type memos, is there any evidence that anybody else would have written something like that and was renewed after this?
Well, I will agree that they were clearly intemperate. We do know that the long, rambling memo of which you speak, Your Honor, was the subject of a meeting of the director, the person whom Mr. Wiley was speaking about and Mr. Wiley, wherein the director said, both of you grow up and stop acting this way, act professionally. And that person thereafter testified that the relationship was indeed professional. Shortly after, the director said, stop sending letters like this, stop sending memos like this, he, to both parties. The other party to this case, a white employee, received an excellent evaluation and a large pay raise. Several months later, when his term came up, my client, for the same behaviors, received a poor evaluation and was terminated. It's a differential in treatment. It's just one of several that show up in the record. And I'm into my rebuttal time.
Thank you, Mr. Watson. Mr. Carroll?
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is John Karoff. I am the Special Assistant Attorney General appointed to defend the state and Director Johnson in this case. I'd like to begin by pointing out to the court that we have to keep in mind the time context of this case. Director Johnson became Director of the Department of Veterans Affairs in February of 1999. He was called upon to decide upon Mr. Wiley's continued employment with the Department of Veterans Affairs in December of 1999. So he had a 10-month window in which to assess this person's suitability for the next 4 years. And so the question then becomes, what was there in that 10 months which could have influenced him one way or the other? And I would submit that there was much going on in the Department of Veterans Affairs during this time which could have clearly influenced and did influence Director Johnson's decision. There's two decisions in this case that the court's being called upon to review. First is, did a prima facie case exist? Did Mr. Wiley succeed in presenting that? And secondly, did he succeed in presenting evidence that there was pretext amiss here? As to the prima facie case, and I understand that the court in the past oftentimes moves fairly quickly to the pretext because the prima facie case is not a tremendous hurdle to overcome. But I think the court did get it right in this case to state there was not a prima facie case present. Mr. Wiley says that he was replaced by a white individual, and therefore he has, in and of itself, set forth the fourth element of the prima facie case. I would point out to the court that this white individual was not hired until 6 months after Mr. Wiley was not renewed. And so to say that second decision, the decision of who to hire to take the position, influenced or was a factor in the first decision 6 months earlier, to me seems a bit of a stretch. I think the gulf there is just too large to say in this case that the replacement has any meaning to the court. So I think the court properly analyzed this case under the standards of he needs to come up with someone similarly situated. And this court has said on many times to us that when we say similarly situated, we mean a very, very close person in the sense of the characteristics about them. It has to be the same supervisor. It has to be the same set of circumstances. There cannot be any mitigating circumstances is the language the circuit has used on several occasions.
Well, was Wiley one of a kind?
One of a kind in the sense of...
So that you couldn't have a similarly situated person?
At this particular time, Your Honor, I think that's a true statement. He was the first term appointee who Director Johnston had occasion to evaluate for purposes of renewal. There were term appointees expiring thereafter, but at this particular point in time, there is no one for Wiley to compare himself to, which I think is one of the real problems in his case in trying to use the indirect method approach. He needs a comparable. He would have to have, in my view, and in the court's view, a person who is similarly situated, i.e. someone who is also being considered for renewal and was not or was renewed, and then there could be a pattern of comparing, all right, why did this person get renewed versus this person not getting renewed? And in this case, there's no one to make that comparison to, which is a real problem for him in this case.
You made a reference to someone else, that this adversarial relationship they had with this long memo, I guess, and the other person apparently wrote one too. I don't know if he did or not. But that he says, well, the other person got a raise and a nice evaluation, and Wiley got non-renewed. Is that a valid comparison, or is that just a different incident altogether?
I don't see the meaning of that. The person they're speaking of, the auditor named Don Bullerman, was in the second year of his term appointment. Mr. Bullerman had come into the agency to take over an audit shop, and this is from Mr. Bullerman's testimony, which is part of the record, to take over an audit shop, which basically was a one-person shop. He came in and did a number of things. His disagreement with Wiley, and it was really, I would say, more a situation of Wiley causing a situation of Bullerman, was just a piece of Mr. Bullerman's entire performance during that period of time. And once the director addressed it with Mr. Bullerman, the situation was gone as far as Mr. Bullerman was concerned. He told them both to act professionally, and he didn't want to see memos back and forth to each other. But apparently it didn't take with Mr. Wiley, because in August of that year, this memo interchange, the initial one that Judge Evans pointed to, was in June. But then in August, Mr. Wiley fires off another memo to the director, calling Mr. Bullerman a pit bull and saying his chain ought to be shortened, and so he didn't get the point. With Mr. Bullerman, there weren't any further incidents. So I think they are not comparable. We have a single incident created by Mr. Wiley's stoking up of the issue versus Mr. Bullerman's otherwise good employment with the department. I don't think they're comparable. So if we don't have a good comparable, Mr. Wiley falls back to the circumstantial evidence approach, which is really a direct evidence approach, but it was analysis, and I disagree with counsel saying that the court ignored it. I think the court did make reference to it in her order about what these bits and pieces of circumstantial evidence. And yes, they are, Your Honor, spelled out on page 32 and 33 of the brief.
Where is it referred to the record? They are set out sort of a bunch of statements, but there's no record reference on page 32 and 33. Do you acknowledge it somewhere in this brief or something that all these are reference to the record?
If you comb through the record, Your Honor, you will find.
I comb through the record.
It's
the brief. Are
in
they
the brief,
set out here?
I don't think in his brief he has set them out in detail, no. But I will tell you that they are in the record, and that in the record, I think they are easily disposed of once you have a sense of the record. He complains much about this scenario in Chicago, the Metro Division of Chicago, where apparently there's lots of complaints from certain employees that there was a anti-racial attitude up there. When you look at Director Johnson's testimony, which I point out in my brief, the person accused of all this bad blood in Chicago, a fellow named Bill Moran, was eventually, by the director, given a very negative evaluation, which led directly to Mr. Moran taking retirement from government service. So he addressed it. The other piece of the Metro issue is there was in Chicago a fellow named Michael Cameron who filed a race discrimination charge against the department, and the Department of Human Rights summarily dismissed that case due to lack of substantial evidence at the investigation phase. So while he raises this issue of there's big problems in Chicago, anyone who's looked at it has taken care of the issue, one way or the other. I don't think it points to a director who is racially hostile towards African Americans. The final instance in Chicago, there was an African American female named Deborah Reed who was denied a leave of absence by Mr. Moran. The director looked into that and reversed it. And Mr. Wiley, candidly in his deposition, says, well, I give him credit on that one. He stepped in and he solved the situation. He gave this African-American female the leave that the white supervisor had denied her. So I don't see that gives circumstances that say this is a racially biased director. We asked Mr. Wiley directly in his deposition, what has he ever said anything to you to suggest to you that Mr. Johnson is racially biased? He said, no, I've never heard a statement like that. I've never read anything which I can point to him. I just think that he allowed this situation to fester, is his word from the record. The counsel raises timing. It was ambiguous. Are the timing of this discharge was suspicious? I don't see anything at all suspicious about the timing. It came right when it had to come. His term was expiring. The director was called to make a decision. So the timing was when it had to be. So I think the judge had it right in this case. Is what is it that Mr. Wiley has raised, even at the outset, would suggest to us that this was a racially biased discharge? But even if the judge is wrong on that, we move to the pretext argument. And did Director Johnston honestly believe the reasons he set forth?
When Wiley was renewed for a four-year term in 95, first time, was there any discussion at that time on his performance? Was that a like, close call, or just no question he was going to be renewed then? And then the problems came when Johnston entered the picture 10 months before.
I don't believe there's anything in the record, Your Honor, to address that, answer that question for you. It was a different director at the time, and I think each director chooses their own team, so to speak. So I don't think there's anything in the record to suggest that he came in under a close call, nor do I think there's anything in the record to suggest the other way either.
Mm-hmm. When you say a director chooses its own team, do you mean that this is a... I know we're not talking about political, but where a director comes in and he can look at people who are term, he may have a person that he thinks, obviously it wasn't in this case, it took 6 months to find him, but if a director finds somebody that's better or would rather have, or somebody who's a friend of his or something, is that enough to just, you're out and the other one's in?
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm not familiar with this term thing, but it sounds like it's something more than just merit.
Absolutely. The Civil Service Code of Illinois says that term appointees can be discharged can be non-renewed with or without cause, and there is no appeal option available to them should they not be renewed. So it very much is a chance for state leaders to pick the senior manager. Since this is a very limited class of people, in this entire agency, there's no more than a handful who have term appointments. So these are the most senior people in the agency who the director has an opportunity only once every 4 years. And keeping in mind, this director came in February, and his term, of course, coincides with the governor's term. This would be his one and only chance to determine who's going to be his chief fiscal officer, a position so important to this director that he thinks that ought to report directly to me. Prior directors had him reporting to a second-level manager. But this director says, I want the chief fiscal officer, the man in charge of my budget, reporting directly to me.
So Johnston came in with the election of a governor, I guess?
Yes, he came in with the election of Governor Ryan.
And 10 months later is when Wiley's term expired.
Correct. On the pretext issue, the issue here, as this court has said many times, it's not whether or not Director Johnston got it wrong about some of the facts. It's whether he honestly believed in the facts that he was acting on. Mr. Wiley spends much time in his brief trying to show us that the director did get it wrong, that there's an explanation for many of these things, and if he had looked deeper and more thoroughly and spent a lot of time on it, he would have gotten to maybe some of the true issues. But that's not the standard. The standard is, given what the director had in that 10-month window, did he honestly believe it? And is what's in here which says that he did not? First, this issue of the appraisal that Mr. Wiley makes much of. Obviously, he gets his appraisal which says acceptable, but if you look closely at the language of the appraisal, that is the third tier of approval. It's not the first or second, so that in itself says something. On the very day that he gets terminated, or not renewed, I should say. So not much can be made of an appraisal given within 2 hours of you not being renewed, I don't think. And Mr. Wiley himself said when he got that appraisal, he knew it was bad. He went back to his office immediately to try to think of a rebuttal to it. So the appraisal didn't do him any good. Mr. Wiley says that Director Johnston did not honestly believe his reasons because he changed his testimony. I think a close look at the record indicates he changed an answer to one question. The question was, you say in an EEOC response, you identified at least three people who he had a problem with. Who were they? And Director Johnston gave three names and went along to explain why he thought that it was true. Upon review of his testimony, he found that the actual EEOC document itself referred to three different people. But he didn't go back and say that the other three weren't at all. He had already made a record that they, too, had significant problems. So really, he identified six people who Wiley had a problem with. And in his deposition, he explains in some detail all six of them and the problems they had with Mr. Wiley. Other testimony in here is this Village Investment Project program and the VMAP program as it's referred to. These items were programs which Mr. Wiley was very much had a part of. He tries to distance himself in his response here by saying, well, I really wasn't totally in charge of these programs, but if you read his testimony and what was presented to the court, Mr. Wiley was very much a part of each of these VMAP programs, and the director held him accountable. His name was on the contract as the contact person within the agency, and so the director was duly correct in saying, Mr. Wiley, I'm holding you responsible for these, and there's no question that there are problems in these programs. The Auditor General, in records that's in the record, said that these programs are not operating with proper rules, and there were errors that caused audit findings to be made on them. So that occurred in that 10-month period. The issue with the Quincy Veterans Home, referred to in the brief, happened within the 10-month period. This interchange with Don Bowerman happened within the 10-month period. All of this happened within the 10-month period, and now we have a director who must say, do I want this man here another 4 years? None of this has anything to do with race, Your Honors. It has everything to do with the quality of performance given by Mr. Wiley. Do the court have any further questions?
Apparently not.
If not, thank you very much.
Thank you, Carroll. Mr. Watson?
I misspoke earlier, Your Honors, when I was asked whether or not the circumstantial evidence that was listed on pages, I think, 32 and 33, or 33 and 34, were the entirety of the circumstantial evidence that should have been considered by the court and should be considered by this court. I ignored the fact that this court in Venturelli also noted that, for all intents and purposes, the pretext arguments need to be considered as circumstantial evidence under the direct method of proof as well. And in fact, although not well set forth, this brief is rife with instances indicating that the director didn't believe what he was saying, or he was so incredibly wrong that it cannot be believed. As the court
pretext is evidence of it's not something that's an indirect method. I mean, yeah, well, if you want to call it direct, it's evidence.
This court recently stated that the third type of evidence under circumstantial evidence is that in the Venturelli case that the plaintiff was qualified, passed over in favor of a person not having the forbidden characteristic, and the employer's stated reason for the decision is unworthy of belief. The court went on to state that the latter category is substantially the same as the evidence required under the indirect method, or McDonnell-Douglas.
If you're talking about pretext.
Yes, correct. Yes. I'm saying that this court should be considering pretext in a number of different ways, rather than merely an element of the McDonnell-Douglas indirect method of proof.
It's not an element of the prima facie case. Pretext is
correct.
Once you establish the prima
facie.
Now we're back to evidence that he was lying, in effect.
Okay. Yes. Intent is almost impossible to prove. Nobody gets up there and says anything that I intentionally. So what kind of proof are we relying on? That in this case, that the director was so incredibly wrong that he could not have believed what he was saying. Take the Quincy Veterans Home issue. There was some issue there about Mr. Wiley holding up commercial laundry facilities for the Veterans Home and that allegedly stating that the residents should simply wear sweats. The director indicates that he doesn't know when he learned about, you know, that. He takes credit for getting the Bureau of the Budget to give the money, although Mr. Wiley indicates that he worked long and hard and indeed worked with the Bureau of the Budget to get the money for those commercial laundry facilities. The director was simply absolutely and incredibly wrong and couldn't have believed his own testimony on that. With regard to the VMAP grant the director stated that it was the misapplication of the grant, the mishandling of the grant money, that was the third reason for terminating my client. But he also then goes on to admit that my client wasn't the person who was in charge of that grant. It was not overseeing the use of the grant money, that someone else within the agency was, and he states that. The director simply made so many factual errors, they couldn't have believed his own testimony.
Mr. Watson, when did you become counsel of record for this case?
Just, I think about a month and a half ago.
And the court has been made aware of that?
I believe so, yes.
We
entered an appearance and Mr. Jones...
Your statement?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, it was quick.
No, I understand. I just didn't have it in my file. All right. Well, we thank you, and thank Mr. Karoff, and the case is taken under advisement.